Michaels and Mary Elizabeth McCarry.
Hello.
Here in the Passion Pit. I know I said no more interviews in 2018, but these two artists came across my desk and I wanted to make sure you knew about their work before it was too late. This emerging Latina producer and actress garnered great praise for a star turn in a new musical called Fort Dix. And now she is starring and producing a new play by Mario Lantigua. It's called Two Faces, One Mirror, and it's about the struggles of a single mother and her unruly daughter. I don't need to shine a light on this go-getter. She has the power of the sun behind her. This is Sunflower Duran.
Congratulations to you. You got wonderful reviews on Fort Dix, and now here you are producing and starring in another show. Good for you. Good for you.
Thank you.
Keep it going. Tell us about the show.
Okay, well, it's the story of a mother and daughter. The mother is disfigured, and her daughter abuses her and takes her for granted, and she just speaks badly to her, and she just assumes all these things about her mom, but she really doesn't understand what her mother's been through in her life and the sacrifices that she has made to take care of her daughter and provide for her daughter. So the play tells the story of how she discovers her mother's sacrifices and how that transformation takes place.
Wow. I didn't know that about the disfigured. Is she disfigured from an accident, or is it something that happens at birth?
She has burn marks on her face and her arm. I can't tell you too much without
of course.
Really spilling the beans.
Wow. Oh, that's intense. That's really great. How is the play going in terms of rehearsal, in terms of building the characters with the actors? How's everything going with that?
Everything is going great. We had our first rehearsal. Now, Mario came up to me about a month ago, or when I was doing Fort Dix, he asked me to read the script that he wanted me to play the lead. And I was focused on Fort Dix, and I said, I will talk to you when the play closes. So when the play closed, I skimmed through the script, and I gave him a call, and I said, sure, I'll play the lead. But I didn't really, like, dive into the script at that time. I just like to go with the energy, and when somebody asks me to make art, I always say yes, no matter how small the part is.
Good for you. Good for you.
So then he said, would you like to produce the play? And I was honest with him. I said, me? Really? I said, well, I produced a trailer for my thing's always been film. I said, I produced a trailer for my feature film that I'm producing and fundraising for, and I'm producing my web series, but I've never produced a play. But I have been in theater for a very long time. Since 2011, I've been doing theater. And I said, I think I could figure it out. In 2 days, I had the entire cast. All the websites were up. And we have almost 200 likes on the page. On the page for the play. So it was like natural. Everything came natural to me because I've been aspiring, or let's say I know that I am. I don't like the term aspiring to be. I feel that artists are born artists. And sometimes they just don't have a platform to create. So I knew that I was an actor since the age of 5. I started studying at 13 years old. And all these years, I've been studying. I never stopped taking classes, and I never stopped learning or reading about art in all forms. I love art all around. So when I started producing this play, everything to do came natural to me. Like, it was automatic.
It's sort of like a bolt of lightning. You just knew this is where you had to be. And here, as you said, was the platform for you to do it.
Exactly. And about 10 years ago, I had this idea. This name came to me. Pink Arts Piece.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. That's a great one. I love the initials. It comes out to Poppy. I love that.
Poppy, yes. It's wonderful because my father is like the driving force behind everything that I do creatively. He's always supported me. I told him when I was out, he was the person that I declared my calling to when I was 5 years old. I remember it like it was yesterday. We were sitting watching novellas, and I said, Poppy, I'm going to be, and I didn't say an actress. I said, I'm going to be the protagonist. And he was like, yes, you are. And he's believed in me ever since.
So it's a little girl, you're saying words like protagonist. There you go. That's pretty good.
Yes, I said that in Spanish, protagonista. And, you know, he supported me ever since. And my mom has supported me, my brothers and my sister. Not so much the world, not so much the world. But now I feel a lot of support from a lot of people, you know. I got made fun of a lot when I was, like, in junior high school and elementary school. And it messed with my confidence for a long time. But then when my parents put me on modeling school at the age of 13, it gave me confidence that I was a different person from that moment. And I just chased my dreams this whole time. And I've been chasing them. And then I realized, I was like, you know what? I don't need a platform. My living room is a platform. Bed Bath & Beyond, the empty aisle while I'm working on demo, is a platform. I can dance. I can sing. I can act. I can. And who's watching is not up to me, because God's always watching. And as long as I follow that calling, everything's going to be okay.
As long as God's in the audience, you're in good shape.
I'm in good shape, and he's always watching. And I felt like I didn't have a voice for a long time. And then I realized, you know, God is watching me. He's with me every second.
Let's talk about your voice for a minute. You are a young Latina woman. Now, people always talk about, you know, how many, there's far too many men in the theater and there's not enough women, et cetera. So that's the first obstacle you have there. And secondly, do you find being Latina an obstacle, or is that something that's opening doors that may not have been there otherwise? Is it good or bad?
I'm very proud to be a Latina woman in, you know, the East Coast, who's representing theater in New York City. Is it good or bad? No, it's not good or bad. It's what it is. It's who I am, and here I am. It's not up to me to decide if it's good or bad.
Do you think you're going to change people's opinion? Or do you think that you're going to be an inspiration to other young women and other Latinos?
I'm going to change the world.
There you
go. I'm going to change the way the entertainment industry operates, at least with my company, because anyone that comes to me and wants to make art is granted. Just the desire is enough.
How do you determine desire? When you say desire, people can come and say, I want to be an actress. I want to be an actor. What do you consider real desire?
Real desire is action behind it. So yes, you can say that. You can speak the words. People say that to me every day on a daily basis. I want to be. Then I say, okay, let's sit down and I'll, you know, show you what to do to get started. And then they say, well, one of these days, or not right now, I have a lot of work. They make up an excuse and they don't take any action. So that's not real desire. That's just a thought.
So you open the door for them and then you say, okay, you need to have the chops to step in.
Yeah, you need to show up.
There you go.
And hold them accountable.
You know, it's funny you say that. Woody Allen used to say that. That was his expression. You know, the first rule of success is just to show up. And that seems very difficult nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you feel your actors? Do you feel the actors that you have now have shown you that they're ready to take the plunge?
100%.
Oh, that's great.
They have shown up.
Oh, that's great.
They have shown up. I cast my niece, who's a YouTube sensation. She has her own YouTube channel, and I feel she's been showing up for herself for a very long time. And I offered her the opportunity, and she got nervous because YouTube's her platform. She said, I'm going to be nervous in front of the stage. And I said, Emily, this is your calling, and you can't ever say no to something that, you know, calls you. And this is your opportunity to work with your aunt in New York City. And she said, okay, I'll do it. And I was thrilled. Jillian and Lindsay are two of my best friends. And they show up not only for the play, but they show up for me every day, day after day. Juan is a colleague that I've worked with in the past, and his dedication is just incredible. He's the first one to fill anything out. He sent me his bio before I even asked for it. He's amazing.
There's the ambition you're talking about. Good.
That's the ambition I'm talking about.
Excellent.
Daniel contacted me on Instagram not too long ago, and he said, I want to be part of everything you're doing.
And there's again the ambition. Good for you.
Mm-hmm. And I said to him, okay, come to rehearsal. Let's see if we can get you into this play.
Now, speaking of platforms, you're at the American Theater of Actors. That is one of the original theaters of the Off-Off-Broadway movement. That's historic where you are. How does that feel that you're producing in such a venue?
It feels just like doing my job. Because it feels like just doing my job. When I get that star on Hollywood Boulevard, I just said, all I did was my job. It's my calling. It's what I was meant to do. And here I am just showing up.
What do you want the audience to walk away from? When they see that show and they walk out of that theater and someone says, what did you think? What do you want them to say? What do you want them to feel from the play?
I want them to feel what it is to be a single mom and struggle and make sacrifices for their daughter. I want them to feel the plot of the play. I want them to feel the emotion that each character in my play can show the audience, can make them feel. I want them to feel the feelings behind the words that Mario has written.
That's great. You passed my test. A lot of times I'll ask that question and I'll hear someone say, oh, I want them to like the play and give me money and whatever. That's not the answer to hear. The answer is exactly what you just said. You want them to understand these characters. You want them to be felt. I think that's great. I think that's great. What's your next thing? What's on the horizon for Sunflower and Pink?
Well, Poppy wants to eventually make it out to L.A. I would always have my production company here in New York because I'll always come home, especially for Christmas. But my desire is to be in L.A. at some point, maybe the next year or two, and perform out there and perhaps even direct. But my production company, I'm setting it up so that I'm named my best friend, Lindsay Kennedy, the CEO of the company. And then I've been hiring several producers. I have a director of operations. I have someone in China with being the director of public relations. International relations, excuse me. And then I have my graphic designer. He works out of India. So I have all this support from all over the place, and I feel so blessed. So I'm going to leave that running in New York while Sunflower herself. Poppy's going to stay in the East Coast, basically, like it was supposed to be.
There you go.
And Sunflower's off to her home because California has always been the place where I want to be.
So you have this multiracial, international company just ready to take the world by storm on two different coasts.
Yeah.
Okay. I got to send you my resume. I think you're the person that has to hire me.
You're hired already.
There you go. This was terrific. This was terrific. I really look forward to the show. I really look forward to hearing all about it. I know you have reviewers coming down to see it. There's articles out there. I will tell our listeners exactly when and where they should go and see this, because you are going to go far and so will the play. So we need to see it now. Thank you so much for this interview. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay. You do wonderful work and it's been a pleasure working with you. And this is only the beginning of a long lasting friendship and working relationship.
You know where to find me. Thank you so much. All the best.
You're welcome. Take care.
Ciao. Bye.
Thank you, Sunflower. That was terrific. Now, Pink Arts Peace Productions, Inc. will present this compelling play by Mario Lantigua. Two Faces, One Mirror. It will be at the landmark American Theater of Actors, 314 West 54th Street, New York City, for a limited run, December 28th through the 30th. Now you can go to Eventbrite and type in Pink Arts Peace Productions, Inc. and get all ticket information, or you can go to the American Theater of Actors website, or you can go to jmichaelsarts.com for a link straight through to the tickets. Okay, now this is a name that has been everywhere. I heard about this artist's acumen when he was choreographing a new production of Two Gentlemen of Verona. Funny story, he ended up choreographing a production of Hamlet that I did, fight choreography that I did. And it's very funny, right before that I said, we should get someone like this guy to be our fight choreographer, and there he was. Then I heard about some powerful work he was doing at The Fringe, and then I saw some powerful work he was doing at Planet Connections. And now, He's part of the Fringe's Off-Broadway Encore series at Soho Playhouse. Let's now hear from the prophetic and prolific Michael Higgins.
Hello.
Michael Higgins.
How you doing?
Good. This is Jay Michaels. If I'm on the phone, you're on the air.
Oh, wow. Okay. Good to hear.
Are you the only one there, or is Brock with you, or anyone like that?
No, Brock's on a different place. We're on the same place right now.
Well, then there you go. Then it's all you. So congratulations, man. This is wonderful. Your show is now one of the best of the fest. This is like the third or fourth time this show has been done?
This is the third time it was in the Fringe, fourth time officially now. So
wow, that's great. So tell all our listeners about Long Rail North.
Yeah, the Long Rail North. Been working on it for about 15, 20 years now.
Wow.
I felt good enough a couple of years ago to actually be heard by human ears. And I have a great cast and a great crew. And every time I do the show, it comes to a new level. And now it's off Broadway. So it's been amazing this entire run.
Soho Playhouse. Gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous. What's it like been for you to 20 years? That's great. What's it like for you as an author to see this show grow like that? It's almost, you could almost say it's like your child. You know, your child is finally legal. So what's it like?
Well, my child can drink now, which is great. So, it's been almost surreal because I never would have thought a show I ever wrote or created or anything would ever get to like a space like the Soho Playhouse. You know, even the Fringe Festival, I tried for 5-6 years to submit original work to the Fringe, and this is the first time this year anything I wrote ever got in, and it's been wonderful because I just, as a writer, I want to go further on. I want to do more work and get my work out there. And I feel like Fringe was the best place to put it out there for people to see it. And now, as another life.
That's great. That's great. You mentioned that you've been trying for a long time. Here's a big question for you, because this is a big kind of production scheme in a lot of your shows that I've seen. Do you think that your writing has grown to make it worthy of the Fringe? Or do you think it's always been ready, but now the time is right? Because your plays deal a great deal in racism, if I can be so blunt. I see a lot of plays that you've done, because I've seen your name everywhere. You're like one of the more prolific authors within the independent theater scene. And I see your work done all the time, and it all has the same sort of theme. There's a sense of racial inequality as a lesson in there. Do you think that you've grown, or has the industry finally turned around and said, you know, this guy's right?
Well, I would say my writing has grown. I wish I could say the second thing, honestly. But honestly, I've grown as an author because most of my plays in the beginning are mostly comedies about sword fighting and about crazy antics and things like that. And it took a little while for me to really find my voice to talk about racism and actually be free enough to say something's wrong. And I mean, writing Long Road North and writing Basement, plays that I've had a long time, I was a little afraid. I admit it, I was afraid to even put them out there because I didn't want someone to look at me and go, oh, here's another angry black man writing about something that's been long gone. And it took a while for me to actually have the courage to say, I can now say this. I can now put my work out there, say racism exists. It existed and it still exists today. And these are the things to point out back then and right now that haven't changed.
You had a play last year at Planet Connection Theater Festivity called Michael is Black. And
yes.
And it was someone essentially playing you, but it was a white actor. That was a really interesting touch. What made you come up with something like that?
Well, it kind of harkens back to kind of the Trayvon Martin situation. What happened was I heard all the news about it and all the reports and all the complaints. And one night I was watching the news and I just started crying. I just couldn't hold back anymore. I just felt so depressed and I felt so angry. And I just started just hitting my pillow and just walking around my room. And I just couldn't contain myself. And finally, after like half an hour of just letting it all out, I just got to my computer and I started writing. I began to write this story basically a one-man show about my life and dealing with racism and dealing with being afraid of the police and being afraid to even talk because I'm scared of my own, how my own voice sounds. And when I was done, I looked at what I wrote. I said, no one can ever read this because it's way too angry, way too vicious. But I just showed it to my best friend, Michael Reese, who played Michael in that play. And he said, you have to do this. You have to do this, and I'll do it with you. And he said, each mission more was like, you know, I'll be with you. Like, I'll be next to you. And I thought, this is my best friend. This is a guy who I can trust with my writing. So I rewrote it a little bit, and I made the play about him because he's the best actor I know. He has the best voice I know. He's a good-looking white man who is talented. And I thought, you know what? If I say this stuff, I'm an angry black man. If Michael Reese says this stuff, he has a problem, and people will deal with it. People will hear it. Because maybe what happened to me, no one would give a damn about, but if they hear it from him, they'll go, oh, this poor white kid, what happened? Let's help him.
And then they all get to go home and go, wait a minute, that was about an African-American guy. Oh, my God. So you sort of sneak a message in there very, very cleverly. Excellent strategy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it was innovative. It was one of those things where I wasn't sure it would work, so I had a workshop production of it a little before I did Atlantic Connections, and it worked. The only problem with the show was people said it wasn't long enough, so that was one of the comments I got. But I actually made it shorter for Planet to make it be just an hour long, and I kind of let it sit down because I want to update it a little bit because I'm not sure what if I'll make it longer or shorter, but I know there's more things that have happened and more stories to tell, so. Also, there's a lot going on between Long Rail and other shows, so it's on the back burner. I'm still working on it.
I get the idea from looking at a lot of your work, even looking at your acting work, because I know you're always playing a swashbuckling character somewhere in Shakespeare. You actually were my fight choreographer, and I didn't even know it until halfway through the production, so that should say everything right there. You're like everywhere. You have a very particular voice when you mention racism. It's not, like you said, it's not an immediate angry voice. It's, you're able to get a message in there very subtly. What do you think your voice is in the theater? If someone said, oh yeah, I'm going to see a play by Michael Higgins, what is it that we're immediately going to think in our brains about you?
Well, I've never believed in being abstract with my work. Not knocking the style, it's just not me. I look at my work more as there's a message in here that's not going to beat you over the head. I want it to be subtle, but you also are going to get it. I don't want to go over anybody's head. I don't want to make it too smart for anybody or too dumb for anybody. I want to be the play itself and the work presented in front of you. Almost every show I have is fight direction in there, fight choreography, because I do it well, I think. So you're going to see good fights in the show. You're going to see hopefully a few strong female leads because we need more female leads out there. And just overall, just I want to present a play that people can enjoy, but also understand the message coming across. That sometimes, I mean, a lot of my plays kind of have the lone black man archetype, as I call it, which is the one black man kind of in a white world, like basements about World War II in France and Long Way North of the Civil War, one black person. And I want to go with that motif a little more, where there's a lone black man in my stories where this person's alone. They have nowhere to go. They don't know what the next step is, but they're going to fight through and persevere.
But their morals, from what I see, their morals within your stories, you say the lone black man, but their morals are things that we all, regardless of race and culture, want to aspire to, because we even see now in this play, in Long Rail North, this soldier is up against everybody to help someone who's not even on his side. I really think it's marvelous that you're finding these people that you're creating these people that have the morals that we aspire to. Is that something that was in the back of your brain, or is that just I have the expression? Are you a genius by accident or on purpose? Was that something that you always said? No, I want people to identify whether they think they should or not, or is it just there?
I'm loath to call myself a genius because I don't want to be that arrogant about myself. But on that same token, though, like I really want people to see themselves in the characters, like in a Cole Car casting, where you have this fiery woman who's supposed to be a certain type, supposed to be demure, supposed to be harmless and just a housewife, or, well, back in that time period, just, you know, the plantation owner's wife. Hmm. And she's not. She's basically like an outlaw. She's a female outlaw who robs trains and keeps getting away from all these bounty hunters. And someone like Molly Barnes, yes, she grew up on the wrong side of the war and believes in all these ignorant things her father taught her, but she's also intelligent. And someone like her is impressionable. And she is possible to have change. She's possible to be different and have a different life. And Thomas gives her that in the show. He shows her a different side of the war, a different side of what slaves are supposed to be. That's kind of the point of the play, is that there's a whole other side of people you don't know because you're raised one way to realize what they are, and then you see them and you meet them and you talk to them and you see the actions they do, and now your mind's blown.
Interesting. Very interesting. What's the next step for you? You're giving us this great archetype to the point of where it really is becoming a prophetic and prolific archetype. What's the next step? What's the next thing that says by Michael Higgins?
Well, I mean, I have three things I'm working on now. They're finished, but I gotta make them longer, essentially. I'm working on like a post-apocalyptic play about several different races and types. People of certain lifestyles who survive the end of the world. So what happens, you know, when there's no more racism in the world because everyone's dead? I'm also working on people stuck in traffic because, you know, it's
happens a road race into the world, actually. But that's beside the point.
Yeah, that's true. So point is, there's a lot of things on the fire right now, but I also want to make sure I give one more attention because this cast and crew, they have been nothing short of amazing this entire time, and I want to make sure they have other things going on too, that I can find them other work. Hopefully cast agents come see the show and cast them in Broadway work and movies, because this whole cast and this whole crew, they deserve so much more than what I can give them right now.
That's really nice of you to say. Yeah, Sublimity without talking business, yes, you're a lot of casting directors, a lot of producers already know about your show. Lists have gone out. As well they should. You're a name that's all over the place in independent theater. It's time for it to be all over the place, period. Michael, thank you so much for speaking to me. I will make sure that our listeners know exactly when your show is. It opens next week. Oh, my God. It's like the last thing to happen in 2018.
Yeah, literally. We had a brush up just last night. We're looking really good. And we have two more rehearsals. We're going to be ready. We're going to be so ready on the 28th. People hopefully will come out and see it because... And honestly, ending 2018 with this show would not be a bad way to end your year, I think.
Wow, that's great. That's really great. Okay, thank you so much. I'm sure we'll be speaking again on a zillion other projects. All the best.
Thank you so much. I'll talk to you later.
Ciao. Mm-hmm.
The Long Rail North opens Friday, December 28th at 7 p.m. and runs through Saturday, December 29 at 7 p.m., with a closing date of Sunday, December 30 at 3 p.m. at the Soho Playhouse, 15 Van Damme Street in good old NYC. Ticket information can be at thelongrailnorth.com or at fringeencores.org. So we're hearing from some new independent producers. Let's talk to one of the pioneers. Mary Elizabeth McCarry has been producing since she was 19 years old. She started the None of the Above Theater Company right after she got out of Brooklyn College. So Mary, I'm hearing all these tales from the new indie producers. What was it like back then at the edge, if you will, of the off Broadway movement?
Well, it was towards the middle because it started one in the 60s. We're talking about starting in the 60s. By the way, Jay Michaels here is talking about writing his doctoral dissertation on the history of...
I like that word. That's good.
I think that's what you call it. On the history of the off-Broadway movement, which actually Jay was telling me, we were talking the other day over coffee, and he was saying that it started in the 1960s in certain clubs in lower Manhattan.
It actually is 60 years old. It started in the very late 50s.
Oh, okay, so it's been a long time.
Yeah.
I certainly am not that old. Okay.
Well, that's why I said you're at the edge.
Not the edge. It's sort of like in, when it was already underway, but in a different way. When I left college, we had a certain class in college that taught us a lot about theater management. And so we were excited to produce our own work, and we did when we were in college. We did several musicals in the school, and then when we left, we were like, okay, we can do this. And so a group of us formed a company called None of the Above Theater Company, and we went ahead and started producing plays like David Mamet. We did different, more absurd plays, and we did more modern pieces of the time. This was like the 80s, 1980s. And what was it like? It was hard. There was no money. We had a membership company at the time, and we weren't the only ones doing that. Everybody chipped in a little bit of money per month, and we then produced whatever play we could do based on that. And then all the actors were then guaranteed some sort of a role, and everybody shared technical work. And, you know, our parents came down to see the shows, and our friends. And I remember my mother once saying, you know, you maybe sit in a theater where fleas were crawling all over the chairs. There were fleas in the theater. This was 18th Street Playhouse, or 18th Street Theater, or whatever it was, off of 6th Avenue on 18th Street. It was above a store, and there were cats, and I suppose there were fleas. So my poor mother sat and got bit during Suicide in B-flat. So there you go. But that's what it was like. It was tough. It was hard. There was no money. It was in back rooms, in dark places. But that hasn't changed. Some. Maybe it has. The most recent thing our company, Genesis, did was at the 13th Street play theater downtown and 6th Avenue and 13th Street. And that still is pretty dark and musty. But most theaters now seem to be clean and nice and well kept. And there's even a dressing room sometimes. We didn't have those things. So that's what it was like.
I think Off Broadway is starting to take a new level, if you will. That's part of the reason why I wanted to do my dissertation on it, because Actors Equity has changed the rules on doing showcases, so you can charge much more. You can invite different kinds of technical work involved in it. You can even proposition actors of all varieties to be part of it. I think it's absolutely great that it's growing like that.
It's more of a professional thing now, whereas before it was more experimental. That
there
would
you
be
go.
A big difference. Before it was, hey, I'm a playwright or I'm a new actor and I want to get my feet wet doing this work in Manhattan somehow build a resume up. And remember, there was no social media at that time either. We had, I forget the name of that magazine, Theater World or Theater...
There was Theater World, yes. There was Theater World. There was Showbiz. There was a whole bunch of
them. Yeah, but there were just magazines that were just sort of listing magazines that just would list all the art in the city before Time Out New York came along and took that up. Or the Village Voice actually did a lot of that as well. But these magazines caused people would actually go get them to look for experimental theater at that time. It was a pretty hot time for playwrights and for, you know, more experimental kind of work. Just coming out of the 70s into the 80s, where things got to be much more commercial. I always said that when Cats came to Broadway, the whole thing was destroyed. That's my opinion.
Harold Prince once said about Cats, when he asked what's it about, they looked at him and said, "Cats! It's about cats!" In the film Angels in America, the character of Roy Cohen, when he's describing the musical, he says, "It's cats! It's about cats!" I love the flea story. I remember my first Off-Broadway play that I directed, and I won't mention the theater, but I'll say my mother went into it to sit down to see the show, and she then walked out. And I had to run down the block to catch her because she swore it was a burnt-out building and not a theater that she was in. Nowadays, the theaters are a little cleaner, so that's how that goes. And here's to the next 60 years of Off-Broadway. Well, folks, that's all. Mary and I are getting out of Dodge, but we'll be back next year. Wow, that sounds so far away now, doesn't it? But it's only about 2 weeks. With a major lineup of indie artists with a tale to tell. And that's what it's all about in the end, isn't it? We all have a tale to tell. We're a community of storytellers who hope to make a difference with our plethora of parables. And all you have to do, dear audience, is listen. From all of us at the Passion Pit, this is Jay Michaels.
And Mary Elizabeth McCarry.
Wishing you a joyous holiday season and a prosperous new year.